Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is Wednesday, February 21st, 2018. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary Magazine. With me, as always, Abe Greenwald, our senior editor. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
Noah Rothman, our associate editor. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
And senior writer Saurabh Amari. Hi, Saurabh.
Hello, John.
Commentary, of course, the 73-year-old monthly of intellectual analysis, political probity, and cultural criticism from a conservative perspective. We invite you to join us at commentarymagazine.com, where we give you a few free reads and then ask you to subscribe. $19.95 for a digital subscription. $29.85 gets you an all-access subscription, including our beautiful monthly magazine, in your mailbox 11 times a year. That March issue, our March issue, should be in your mailboxes sometime in the next week. It's one of the best we've done. Very Israel-heavy. A lot of Israel stuff this time. Me on Trump and Israel. Mayor Soloveitchik and Michael Medved on Vice President Pence and the evangelical relationship with Israel. Benny Morris, the new Israeli historian, on the origins of the American-Israeli friendship dating back to the first American ambassador in the late 1940s. A wonderful essay by Peter Himmelman, the Grammy-nominated musician, on music and faith. Terry Teachout on the musical Chicago. A bunch of other stuff. Really great issue. Online now, I think. Is it online now?
Yes.
It's online now. And in your mailboxes next week. So a lot of riches there. Gentlemen, we have seen a new series of indictments from Robert Mueller on these, was it 13 Russian nationals who were manufacturing, who were attempting by fair means and foul to affect the results of the 2016 elections. Other news in the probe include the fact that we now have the first evidence that Paul Manafort, the former Trump campaign chairman's associate, Gates, whose first name I can't remember.
Rick
Gates, is now turning state's evidence, basically. And there is his lawyer has now been
pleaded guilty.
Has pled guilty to lying to the FBI about Manafort and Gates. There are stories now floating around that, as I understand it, Manafort had somehow spent $10,000 in 1 month or something like, or $100,000 in 1 month at a CVS in Arlington, a drugstore in Arlington, Virginia, so rather similar to the famous $920,000 in rugs that he spent at the rug store in Arlington. Clearly some version of bizarre money laundering going on there. And so the probe at least is racking up numbers, right? Even though we have no idea whether it's getting closer and closer or further, something like that. Ross Douthat in the New York Times, I think, had a very sensible column today that I think we should take off from, in which he said that there are two sides to this probe. One is the question of whether or not the Russians, with Guccifer and other meat, were using electronic means to interfere and to wreak havoc with our elections and to push the, and to somehow, you know, sort of like push the scales in Trump's direction with some form of collusion from the Trump campaign. That's side one. Side two is the question of whether or not the whatever would be the current day extension of the KGB's famous disinformation department, which for, you know, 60 years created what it literally was fake news and disseminated it through the world, usually of an anti-American nature, in order to sow discontent with the United States, particularly in allied countries in the third world, that disinformation office is now was effectively transmuted and deployed to manufacture news stories to so and wreak havoc with the 2016 election. And Ross says that the meddling probe has to be taken very seriously and that people are going insane on the people are going insane on the question of the
fake news
and its effect, which if you look at it, you take a look at it. Noah, tell us like what it looks like.
Oh, from the social media campaign? Well, what really had people's eyes popping from this indictment was the revelation that this was a concerted effort from a group with the acronym or initialism IRA. I forget what it stands for, but it was this basically a company that was designed and really well-funded to create media to advance the Kremlin's political objectives, which were essentially chaos. And this operation was funded to the tune of $1.2 million per month on average. It wasn't a cheap operation. But what they produced is kind of ridiculous. And we can get everybody's thoughts on some of this stuff. I mean, this was presented before Congress. I'm not pulling these examples out of thin air. This is what Democratic members of Congress put up before the American people and said, this is what was designed to influence your election. It was stuff like Jesus and Satan arm wrestling with a caption saying, click like to help Jesus win, saying that, you know, Satan wants Hillary to win. That's the sort of thing that was supposed to change your mind. There was as Texas secessionist movement that was advanced by some of these Kremlin objectives with a meme promoting advertising against, quote, Hillary rotten Clinton. And, of course, buff Bernie, because this indictment suggests – now, this is Bernie Sanders, who is just really jacked. And this indictment suggests
that the Russians were
also actively trying to support Bernie Sanders' campaign, because Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump were the candidates of frustration, of antipathy towards the status quo, and particularly antipathy towards the existing structures of Republican democracy in the United States as we know it.
Right. So memes, is, you know, in case our listeners don't know, they're effectively cartoons using actual images with slogans or caption pictures. You could liken them to advertising, or you could liken them to like a cartoon, and they're called memes, and so they spread around, and hopefully the people who create them want them to go viral so that, you know, they...
So one that was particularly nefarious, according to these members of Congress, was an image of Aziz Ansari, the comic, who was holding up a placard in a picture, and the placard read that you should vote on election day by tweeting a particular hashtag. And that was supposedly evidence to the extent that this was altering the outcome of the election, right. Because that's kind of in doubt. So if you were dumb enough to think that you could tweet a hashtag, tweet Hillary Clinton from home, and that would constitute your vote, that's essentially the only public evidence that we have.
It would probably help the Republic if you didn't vote.
I think if I remember correctly from the indictment, that they had evidence that a rally was held under the auspices, maybe of this Texas secession movement. I'm a little confused.
Well, after the election,
15 people, at which 15 people showed up. Now remember, we're talking about Trump could have anywhere between 5 and 25,000 people at a rally. So the fact that they got 15 people to show up to something is meaningless. And this is all very striking, because I think everybody has to take very seriously the question of whether or not there was electronic interference in the campaign. But it is the sexiness of this notion that fake news was being peddled that would have had an effect on the 80,000 people in the three states that helped get Trump elected, that is leading people like Thomas Friedman of the New York Times to say our democracy is under attack as it has never, you know, it's like 9/11 or it's like Pearl Harbor. I think he says it's like Pearl Harbor. And this is insane. Does anyone not think it's insane?
No, I think it's completely insane. And when you have a campaign that looks like the work of like an absurdist prankster, I don't know how you then don't lose some of the zing of your outrage, at least in terms of how it lands on the public, when you're screaming your head off about how we are under this crazy attack and... you're traitorous not to take this more seriously. Now, I think you should take it seriously insofar as whoever is responsible for this should be found and prosecuted and taken seriously. But we have to keep a sense of scale here. And when the sense of scale is brought to bear, I don't understand how people who are screaming their heads off about how this was some huge attack upon our democracy are going to sustain any support. I think they're going to end up looking foolish.
There was a deep discontent in the country, especially among white working class people, others, and to which neither party was responsive. It resulted in the unlikely, mind-boggling fact of first Trump winning the Republican nomination and then ultimately the election. The right response for the left would have been to try to figure out what it is and how it can rejigger its program or its identity to appeal to these people next time around. I see a lot of this as an attempt to grapple with a thing that cannot be, that shouldn't be, which is the Trump presidency. Increasingly, I'm not saying it's not serious. I'm not saying I'm glad that Mueller is doing what he's doing, and that this is an assault. This is a kind of behavior from Russia that, if you were living in places like Moldova or Ukraine or Estonia, you know. So, for example, or Sweden or Finland, where Russians, for example, would advertise to ethnic Russian populations in Nordic countries saying that your government wants to take your children away and hand them over to homosexual couples, right? This was what ethnic Russians in Finland would hear. And it's the kind of thing that would rile them up against their own government. And the audacity that the Russians would try it on the U.S. is alarming, and we should respond to it. Sure. But to suggest that it altered the outcome of the election in a significant way, and then to begin to think whether there was collusion. I mean, that's the other thing, is I still don't see where is the collusion in all of this.
Well, the collusion in the fake news or the collusion in general?
Collusion in the fake news.
Well, there is no collusion in the fake news. The whole point about disinformation is that it is peddled in order to rile up a certain populace in the direction that is designed to rile.
But is it not the left's case that somehow, I mean, in a vague way, they right. say that the Trump campaign okay. had some hand in this?
I don't think they're saying the Trump campaign had some hand in that. I think what they are saying is that in general, Russia's effort to get Trump elected was something in which they were at the very least complicit, and the very least and the very most involved in some direct way. But this, I don't see the direct connection between this stuff and them, in part because the whole notion that you change, think about that money. It's $1.5 million a month, right? So over the course of a year, what is that? That's $18 million. Do you know what the online budget of what Hillary Clinton was spending online per month? Was probably $18 million a month online, yeah. if not more. I mean, if you're talking about scale, you know, that would be a lot. $1.8 million a month would be a lot in a primary, maybe, for a couple of months, certainly in a senatorial primary.
Facebook made $28 billion in 2016.
Yeah, right. So $18 million of the $28 billion that Facebook made was spent on this. And there have been a couple of studies. Brendan Nyhan of Dartmouth led a study to try to figure out what the practical effect was of the fake news, clearly hoping to find that it had a powerful effect, and finding instead that it would only have affected people who were already extreme partisans in the first place, who did not really need much pushing to want to go vote for Trump over Hillary.
I mean, that's the thing. I think, you know, barring some sort of version of the butterfly effect, if you had not had this campaign at all, nothing would have looked different in the slightest. We were dealing with the identical situation among the voting public. They had the same concerns. They were all outraged in the same directions anyway. This cannot have changed a thing.
Right. Now, I think Sora makes an important point, which is there is grappling with new political reality, and then there is embracing ideas that make you think that you have no reason to change. So the Democrats love the idea that Trump was elected legitimately, because of course that would mean that none of their issues, none of the things that are animating them or pushing them need to change. Now, we had the same circumstance in the Republican Party after 2012, and it was the Republican Party's official explicit position that it needed to examine what it was that had led to these two straight defeats and what the trends were that were going to lead to if nothing changed, what would happen. That was the famous autopsy, overseen by the RNC, that said we need more outreach to the young, to Hispanics, to all that. And it turned out that this was maybe true in the long, long run, but completely wrong in the short run. That what they needed to do, as Trump proved, was intensify their appeal to exactly the people that Mitt Romney was uncomfortable intensifying his appeal to, right? That they needed a Trump to dig deep and hard into that white working class discontent. And maybe the Democrats are right. Maybe if they wildly intensify their hatred of Trump and the way they push it and the kind of culture war that they represent, maybe they can generate the kind of negative enthusiasm that Trump did in 2018 and 2020 and take things back.
I have a theory that doesn't have a lot of supporting evidence, so it shouldn't even be vocalized at this point, but we've seen a lot of snapback in these legislative elections, and the most astounding occurred last night. And I think it was Kentucky. It was somewhere in the border south, and it was a legislative seat where Donald Trump won by, I guess it was like 40 points, high 30s, low 40 points, and the Democratic candidate won that race by another 30 points, 40 points, something like that. It was like a 90-point shift. It suggests, which is almost unheard of. It's ridiculous.
Is this a state right. seat or a
state legislature? Yeah. So, assembly in Kentucky, right. if it was. What that would suggest to me is that, you know, Donald Trump's capacity to slough off all this, you know, stodgy conservatism, limited government stuff, has convinced some of these Clinton-voting centrist Democrats in the South that they don't need all this stodgy conservatism when you can just take, you know, Democratic prescriptions wholesale. And to the extent that Donald Trump has not lived up to his promise on the campaign trail in that sense, then you can go back to Democrats as long as they're not voicing any of this annoying identity politics that they do on the coasts.
So this is a real question then. The real question here is, are these probes helpful or harmful to the Democrats going into 2018 and 2020? Because there are two ways of looking at it, one of which is they're helpful because they keep Trump in the news, they make him look like he's a crook, they keep Democratic anger up and all of that. The harmful will be that they have no incentive to modify their message. And, you know, we've seen all this stuff about how if they don't modify their message on energy, they'll never win Pennsylvania again, that the war on fracking and coal and all of that in Pennsylvania was what turned the tide, and that they need to find some way to talk about this more moderately, or they're not going to get these people back, whatever. Okay, so I sort of incline toward they're doing what they're doing because that's who they are, and that this is a legitimate and honest response. When Tom Friedman says this is Pearl Harbor, he means that it's Pearl Harbor. Now, Tom Friedman is an idiot, so he can say what he says and be an idiot. I don't care how many Pulitzers he's won, he's an idiot. Having said that, he reflects a certain body of totally mainstream opinion that says that America is under, you know, unprecedented attack from Russia. Fine. So maybe that's good for them. Makes them feel a little hawkish, gets a little blood up. They don't have to just be, you know, wusses. They can actually, you know, be tough on something while they're being totally liberal and leftist.
Well, with zero policy implication. In other words, beyond this issue of keep the probes going and put Trump under pressure, as we've said many times on this, it has not triggered this anxiety about revanchist Russian aggression around the world has not triggered any rethink of overall democratic
because
foreign
it's
policy
a lie.
Thinking.
It's all an obnoxious lie. I feel like this is
which
this
is a lie.
Now you guys know me. I'm not the biggest fan of Donald Trump in the world, but the notion that his Russia policy has been entirely negligent on the threat posed by Russia is not supportable, and it's like listening to a crazy person who doesn't hear you when you have all these Democrats and their apologists in media on Twitter saying this president has done nothing to support the effort to contain Russia, to control an expansionist Russia, to respond to the threat of from cyber posed by Russia. It's like they're not hearing and don't want to hear and are not interested in the facts, and that sort of thing is not really sustainable in the long run,
right,
because
okay.
especially because Donald Trump himself and the administration are beginning to pivot to a winning message for them, which is to outline and illustrate the extent to which they have been harder on a revanchist Russia than Barack Obama has. It is not a hard case to make, and it's one that is pretty convincing when it's made thoroughly.
Yeah, but it's true. When you speak to them, I mean, I've come across this a lot. It's as if they're responding to some sort of larger hidden truth that trumps all the actual facts and the policy details. It is quite the matter of theology at this point. I mean, they will absolutely not. They're looking for red flags as well.
I mean, the president himself is awful on this issue because
his
ego seems to be bound up in the notion that if he admits to Russian meddling, then it will somehow detract from the fact that he's the president of the United States.
Right. Well, it is awful. But, you know, I watched the other night CNN had a panel on, and then they did a fact check because Trump said, do a fact check on who was tougher, me or Obama. So CNN did this barely with a tone of sneering contempt, this fact check, which was about the Russia meddling probe. And on this matter, Obama expelled 35 diplomats in December of 2016 and was worried about it and had meetings about it and all that. Slow to act. But Trump hasn't done anything except attack the probe, and therefore he's wrong, and Obama was tougher. But that is not what Trump said. Trump said, who's tougher on Russia, me or Obama? And there is no question that Trump's administration over the last 14 months has been tougher on Russia than Obama was. In matters of policy, geopolitical, geostrategic policy, Trump has been harder on Russia. Obama went soft on Russia because he wanted their help with Iran first. Obama went soft on Russia because they decided they were going to take this cup from his lips on Syria in 2013. Obama went soft on Russia when they invaded Ukraine. Obama went soft on Russia, period. Obama said to Medvedev, I'll have more flexibility after the election when I don't have to face down Mitt Romney. And Medvedev, the then supposed
In fairness to the Obama administration, it was 2014 and the invasion of Crimea and the annexation of Crimea and the carving up of the Donbass region where they stopped this process of just caving to Russian demands and outsourcing the responsibilities of a superpower
now,
to Moscow and started sanctions. But the Trump administration maintained all those sanctions, including the 2016 sanctions, built upon them, added Magnitsky Act sanctions, and sold Patriot missiles and liquid natural gas to Poland and armed Ukraine, et cetera, et cetera. And seized a whole bunch more diplomatic property than Barack Obama ever did.
And the whole point, as Michael McFaul, the Obama-era ambassador to Russia, said, the whole point about Putin and Hillary is that Putin didn't like Hillary personally. He thought she was rude. He thought she was impertinent. She gave him a hard time in meetings. He decided he didn't like her. He didn't want her to be president. It was personal. It was personal, and it was this sense of aggrievement, probably misogynistic aggrievement, that led to this happening.
I think there was more to it than that. I did some interviewing of some Russian ideologues, most notably Dugin, who the extent to which he has influence in the Kremlin, you know, is contested. But there's a sense that they thought that with Trump they could speak in a sort of nation state interest, we may be opposed, but it's clear, rather than this kind of transnationalist, you know, Merkel, Hillary, Obama style of liberalism both kind of very weak in the face of certain global challenges, on the other hand, very, very invasive of sovereignty. I think that there was some of that there.
I'm sure, but Putin really personally disliked Hillary.
Absolutely. But the other point that I would make is that if you were going by what Trump had said in 2015 and 2016 alone, you have every reason to be terrified, as I was, and as which is why I opposed him. And I make no apology for that, because remember, he would say that NATO is obsolete, and he would say that he would never criticize Putin, and in fact would go out of his way to praise him, and all this sort of thuggery.
As president as well. As president.
Especially early on, remember the
Bill O'Reilly judge, right? We were killing ourselves.
Yeah.
But that's changed. I mean, you cannot. As much as I have that in my mind, I find it repulsive, the fact that he got away with that as a candidate. The fact is that as a president, as an administration, he's unquestionably tougher. And so when he tweets that, I'm amazed by the responses by liberal journalists that exactly like John said, that the sneering and the fact-checking, which isn't really fact-checking.
But it's the opposite of fact-checking. That's the point. In point of fact, it's impossible to argue that Obama was tougher on Russia in aggregate, in toto, than Trump has been. And so they simply misrepresented the question to begin with. Okay, so something else. I just got back from vacation. You can't beat a vacation. But did you know, Noah, that the average family visits 5 totally different websites before booking a vacation rental? I mean, you can spend less time planning your next trip and more time relaxing with Tripping.com, the world's number one site for vacation rentals. Tripping.com is trusted by millions of travelers and featured by the New York Times, Travel and Leisure, Forbes, and more. Whether you're looking for a cabin or a beachfront home to get away to this winter, or already looking ahead to vacations this spring, Tripping.com can help you find the perfect place to stay. Vacation rentals offer flexibility, perks, and amenities that hotels don't, like multiple bedrooms, backyards, hot tubs, free Wi-Fi, even fully stocked kitchens so you can plan and cook your own meals. Great for families and large groups. With Tripping.com, one search lets you filter, compare, and sort over 10 million available properties on trusted sites like VRBO, TripAdvisor, Booking.com, and more. Don't wonder if you're getting the best deal. You'll save an average of 18% per night by booking your vacation with Tripping.com. So don't forget, if you want to save time and money while booking the perfect vacation rental for your next trip, head to tripping.com/commentary today. That's TRIPPING.com/commentary. tripping.com/commentary. Now we're of course still dealing with the horrendous aftermath of the Parkland shooting at the Stoneman School, and the fact that we now seem to have a grassroots student movement arising to seek the imposition of tighter gun restrictions or new gun laws or something like that, being led by the students at the school, but joined in potentially nationwide. There's going to be some sort of day of something or other. I can't remember. It's a day of something. What seems to be the most important fact today is that George and Amal Clooney have donated money to it. Because it's one thing that things happen, but if George and Amal Clooney are going to donate money, then I think obviously the world is about to change.
So I have a question for everybody. Does anybody know what specific legislation we're trying to advance here?
Well, what's interesting is the only specific piece of legislation that I am aware of that is up being discussed is being discussed by supposed gun nut David French in National Review, which is a California law that does something or other.
Yeah, nobody's talking about that. Yeah, no, he wrote a very reasoned piece
about an actual thing
restraining orders that is
gun right that a family member can actually, family member or an intimate of someone can seek out a restraining order that would prevent somebody from getting a gun or, a legally licensed gun.
Right. You go through the temporary process and the final process. No, what I understand is to the extent that anybody is being honest about what they're advocating here, it is to expand background checks. Now, what do background checks expansion mean? It means expansion to private sales, which is the only avenue by which gun background checks can be circumvented. which, to the best of my knowledge, has nothing to do with what happened in Parkland or any other of the most recent mass shooting events.
Right. So I think what you're now not talking about practical efforts to close the specific barn door of an event like Parkland, right? So we it's not clear what we know exactly how we got the AR-15, but as far as I know, I'm not quite sure. But that's not the issue. The issue now is we live in a country, there are all these guns, people are taking them and shooting up places. And so something has to be done to tighten the ability of people to get these guns. That's the policy, right? So I was thinking back to the fact that what are we now worried about? We're now worried about assault weapons, right? We're worried about assault rifles. There was an assault weapons ban, right, in 1993. In 1981, when the modern gun control movement began, the modern gun control movement had nothing to do with assault rifles. When James Brady and Ronald Reagan were shot by John Hinckley in front of the Washington Hilton in 1981, James Brady's wife, Sarah Brady, started the first really successful gun control organization in the United States. Do you remember what it was called? It was called Handgun Control, Inc. It was not called Assault Rifle Control, Inc. It was not called Assault. It was called Handgun Control, Inc. And they had great difficulty getting legislation passed because we were in the middle of a huge crime wave. And the general proposition that was being advanced in more rural states was, what exactly is it you want us to do? We live 50 miles from the nearest police station. Someone's going to come into my house. I'm not allowed to have a gun if he's going to come in, if he's an ex-con coming into my house either to rob or to rape my wife or something. You can't protect me as a practical matter. I have to be allowed to have a gun in my house. And that was one of the reasons that handgun control failed in a lot of places, where there, as opposed to places like New York and Chicago and other places like that, where there are large police forces. And even though I'm just saying, as a practical matter, this was a great failure. And so the gun control movement then moved on to assault weapons with, or what they called assault weapons, with the, I think, practical understanding that while you might need a handgun for protection, it's not entirely clear, and you need a certain type of rifle for hunting. It's not entirely clear what the purpose is of having a military-grade weapon in your house would be. Except once they started advancing on this notion, like, why should you have X? You don't need X. Why should you have X? That was where Democrats and where the NRA became a Republican entity, effectively, and where its power grew exponentially. From 1993, the first assault weapons ban, Bill Clinton said the assault weapons ban is one of the two things that got Republicans the Congress in 1994. The development of the argument for gun ownership through, and the idea was the government is coming to take your ability to protect yourself away and your right to buy a piece of to buy an object that you were allowed to have in your home. And if they do this, what else are they going to take away from you? Practically speaking, I don't see how anything that happens now, including these horrible events, changes that calculus for the people who want to own guns. They're not shooting up a high school. They're not shooting up the Mandalay Bay parking lot. They're not doing anything. They're just buying things that they want. And you're telling me I can't do that. Why can't I do that? How is this national conversation about guns going to change that in the minds of people who care about gun ownership? I don't know.
It's not. Right. But that's not
even
what this
is
about.
Even if you wish that it were, even if you think this is the most important thing on earth.
Well, here's what, I mean, it's mundane, but the president sort of did an about face yesterday. He ordered his Justice Department and the ATF to quote unquote ban bump stocks several months after this mattered.
These are those magazines.
It's an attachment on the back of a gun that uses the physics of the firing of a weapon to force the trigger back into your finger and create the effect of an automatic weapon, even though it doesn't really do that. It's complicated. The bottom line is the Department of Justice said, we can't do that. You're going to need, when this came up last October, you're going to need congressional action on this. 4 months later, Trump says, no, forget about Congress. You're just going to do this. Nobody seems to have voiced much objection to this. And aside, that's a really good sign for people who don't think the DACA deadline is really March 5th and that this thing is really unconstitutional and the DOJ really can't do anything about it because the president just sort of upended his own suggestion that this thing was unconstitutional and you need legislation to achieve that. Well, aside.
By the way, the NRA is against the ban. They said they're interested in sort of limits on
so
it.
So according to all the background reporting we've seen, mostly from places like Axios and reporter Jonathan Swan, who's really pretty well connected, but Maggie Haberman as well, the president who spent his formative period in Manhattan around a bunch of Democrats as a centrist Democrat himself, is really interested in moving something on guns. It would require legislation, most likely, but he's not a big fan of firearms per se. His sons are, but he doesn't really seem to be a big fan of this sort of thing. So he's entertaining these options. The problem is that nobody in his party is all that interested in it, and Democrats aren't advancing anything that I think could really find bipartisan support.
Okay, so again, so I think you made a deeper point, Noah, which is that the banning of the bump stock is not something that the president can do legitimately. Almost everybody who knows these things says that is not an executive action, that he can, that the ATF can impose a nationwide ban on the sale of a piece of private equipment without Congress doing something to say that this is, and therefore passing constitutional muster, by the way, on the grounds that what right does anybody have to say you can't buy anything? You have to make an argument constitutionally that that process of private exchange can be interfered with. But if you can, then you can do anything, can't you? Like, you say the deadline's March 5th. Guess what? Trump issues a statement saying a DACA is now unrescinded for 2 months. Why not?
There's an existing order that says they have to keep accepting applications right now. So there's a lot of people who aren't really sure whether March 5th is the deadline and aren't acting like it.
But the deadline was set by Trump, right? It was rescinded according to Jeff Sessions. March 5th was the date at which it was supposed to end and Congress was supposed to act. But as people have been pointing out now, you know, for years, and is getting more and more worrisome, Congress does not seem to wish to protect or guard or be jealous of its own constitutional role in our republic, which is that it makes laws. Congress makes laws. The president signs laws into being and administers those laws. He does not make law. Executive actions are not law. Obama opened a Pandora's box by pushing this point beyond the breaking point. And apparently, the odd part of this is that Congress is not jealous of its own power. This was something that the founders could never have anticipated. How could the founders have anticipated that a body of people coming together to work in politics would, as Jonah Goldberg says, be more interested in going on Morning Joe than on legislating? If you want to talk about a crisis in our democracy, it is this wildly lopsided power that we have invested in the executive that Congress is refusing to balance.
Right, the ambition for power is not checked by the ambition to be famous, per se.
Well, that is power.
I mean, it's a form of power.
How can you? Yeah, the distinction is really becoming pretty easily blurred. Being one of 535 people is definitely not as big a deal as being one of, you said, on the B block. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that lunatic congressman, that Republican congressman from Florida, Matt
Gaetz. Yeah.
You know, he's just, he himself said, like, he didn't expect to become this media star, but he'll talk to anybody if they ask. He'll talk to MSNBC. He'll talk to Russia Today. He doesn't. He'll talk to anybody.
I'm paraphrasing. But somebody asked him if he was afraid he was being made infamous rather than famous, and he replied, "What's the difference?"
Right. Well, and you know, he'll say anything and all that. So I think that that's a larger point here, which is that the idea is that some Rubicon was crossed by this shooting. Now, why the Rubicon was crossed by this shooting as opposed to any other shooting, I'm not clear, except that I guess if you shoot up a high school now, that there's social media and stuff like that, there's a way of organizing people that there was less before.
I have to say that we forget, but it felt this way after Newtown as well.
Newtown was first graders, right? Newtown was first graders and a principal and a couple of teachers. There is some qualitatively different effect from having these students stand up and say, I was in there. I saw the blood on the floor. I saw my friend shot next to me. I saw, you know, this cannot be allowed to happen. And I think everybody in the country who isn't, you know, just totally, you know, driven by ideology understands not only that emotion, but the feeling that there is something deeply diseased in the in a nation in which these things are now happening with distressing regularity, where an individual person, you know, can mass shoot, you know, and not be prevented from doing so. And all of the solutions that seem to be promulgated, you know, arming teachers, that sounds fun. That sounds nice, right? I mean, don't want to be armed?
I was a school teacher for 4 years. You don't want to feel like you're at any point you have to pull a gun. It's absurd. It's one of those solutions.
Saurabh, where were you a school teacher?
In Brownsville, Texas.
In Brownsville, Texas. If there were a place on earth where teachers would happily bring guns to school,
it's unbelievably crime-ridden.
It would be Brownsville, Texas.
You don't want to be an action hero. You just want to do your job. It's one of those bizarre proposals. I do think, I mean, I used to be more absolutist about the Second Amendment. A few more of these, and I think, and I don't know if the consciousness will change. I don't want to at all. I'm not in favor, like my good friend Brett Stevens, in favor of repealing. But I don't see why we can't, you know, restrict assault rifles, you know, or why we can't restrict access.
This will change some minds.
Well, I don't know. So it changed your mind, right.
I'm not sure if it changed. It just
okay.
I don't
Here's
see what the barrier
thing.
Is. Second Amendment-wise.
Yeah, the answer is we will be able to restrict the sale of assault rifles as a national matter if 60% of the public believes it and votes that way and votes people out who disagree and support the alternative. And that is where the rubber meets the road here with all of this, which is that people who own guns do not want their rights to own guns restricted, and it is a voting issue for them. And the question is, can this be made a voting issue, a measurable voting issue for people who don't own guns and don't want others to own them?
And John, you made it probably the most salient point that is being ignored by people who have their own personal hobby horses, is that it feels like a societal sickness because it is so isolated. This is incidents of mass violence are going up as gun violence in general is going down. So it's not as though guns are the entire problem. It's not as though mental health is the entire problem. When these things happen, journalists forget everything they know about copycat phenomena and just heap undue attention on the mass killers and the fact that we know that this is the kind of thing that incentivizes mass shootings. It's a holistic problem that's going to require holistic solutions.
I also want to point out, which I have done on Twitter occasionally, and this is not a conspiracy theory thing at all, but just to go back to the bump stocks crime, we still have absolutely no idea what happened at the Mandalay Bay Hotel. We have no idea. We don't know when this guy was killed. We don't know who was in the hotel corridor. We don't know whether there was a second gunman. We don't know anything. We don't know anything about motive because of the Las Vegas police and the Las Vegas Sheriff's Department wildly mishandled every aspect of this investigation, and we are totally in the dark. I mean, that is to say, you wild rampant theory can suggest all kinds of things with stuff like this, including that, you know, the mass shooting was a way of covering up an individual hit. You know what I mean? Like, that you shoot a lot of people to cover up the fact that you were trying to shoot one individual person or something like that. I mean, that's where putting all these things together and acting like they're all one thing is a terrible mistake. And the fact that we don't, the fact that you have people on the right who say, arm the teachers, that they're saying that solely because they need to say something, right? They have to say something where they can say, there's a good way to stop this. I mean, if in my day, you know, the teacher would have a rifle in the classroom, and if somebody got out of line, you know, he would shoot them. Or, you know, whatever. You know, one of those, like, ridiculous in my day things, you know, or something like that. You know, in countries like, you know, in Israel, which had a massive terrorist problem, it's not as though Israelis walk around with guns on their hips. If you live in the West Bank, if you live in certain places in the West Bank, sometimes you have to have weaponry in your car, but you have bulletproof glass, you have all kinds of stuff that the government helps you with. But it's not like they were walking around during the Intifada with guns on their hips. I mean, you don't...
a pretty stricter process to get a weapon.
It's a reasonably strict, but it's not that strict. On the other hand, it's less strict than the propaganda you're reading over the last couple of weeks.
On the other hand, John, I want to make a point that you've made that I think is really salient. Is conservatives, even ones who are horrified by these incidents, into thinking, you know, maybe we should rethink some aspects of gun access in this country. You know, we should be worried about eroding this country's martial culture, which is in the sense that the America that a lot of conservatives love as a force on the world stage, in part that's because we have a gun culture, and the two are inseparable. And now that gun culture has nothing to do with the vile madness of this Cruz fellow. But if we restrict the Second Amendment rights too much, and I say this having just said maybe we can do things at the margins, would we lose that martial culture and become another European country that can't defend itself?
I mean, this is a complicated, and it's really a philosophical question that goes to sort of governing philosophy and political philosophy, which is that can you expect the United States to be, if you like it, a lot of people don't like it, including a lot of liberals, but if you expect the United States to function in some sense as the world's policeman and to be willing to use force of arms to help maintain, you know, the international order and stuff like that, if you say to individual Americans that you are not... independent, you should not own a gun, and that guns are bad, if the general national idea is that guns are bad, then army guns are bad, then missiles are bad, then nuclear submarine, then nuclear warheads are bad. Now, as I say, this is a view that is shared by a great many people, whereas the general proposition that we would go with on the question of how the use of force is it sometimes a moral act or is something you have to do to preserve things that are better, is that you cannot imbue these weapons with anthropomorphic qualities. They're neither good nor bad. It is a question of what you do with them. An American holding an AR-50 because he's attempting to extirpate ISIS is different from someone in ISIS holding the same weapon, aiming it at the American. Because we're good and we're trying to end terrorism and create order there, and they're bad because they want to behead people and kill children. So the weapon isn't the issue. It's the agency of the person holding the weapon that's the issue. If you imbue these weapons with anthropomorphic personality, you are endangering America's sense of itself as an active country that will sometimes use violence to further good causes.
I don't know if the people who are, this sort of tie in the first segment and the second segment, I don't know if people who are afraid of the prospect of these weapons in private hands would be so afraid of it in the hands of trained military professionals, because they're in an institution which is constraining them, and they generally believe in institutions. I don't think they think that they themselves are the problem, is that they themselves trust themselves not to be manipulated by Russian propaganda. They don't trust you.
Oh, right.
But they don't trust you to have a gun. They trust themselves to have a gun.
Yeah, but I don't think they I don't think they trust institutions. Their trust in institutions it depends on who's president at the time.
Right. And I also think this is a very, I mean, maybe a point to close on, that when you were talking about individual people, there are, you know, 36% of the households in the United States have a gun in them. If you listen after one of these events, what you hear is the notion that a one in a million event is something that requires a national response that will affect the choices of those 36% of homes. And that is, in the end, the political calculation and why this will fail. Because those people don't want to give up their guns or their right to own guns. And the people, and they're willing to submit to a lot of, they're willing to submit to background checks. They're willing to do this. They're willing to do that. But the notion that they are being told that they are more like Nicholas Cruz than they are like the people who hate guns is one that will not stir them to change their political views. If you call someone a mass murderer, you are not going to win them over to your side. And effectively, the logic of a lot of what we've heard over the last 2 weeks is that anyone who owns a gun is either a mass murderer or a potential mass murderer. And that is an argument that is doomed to fail. So, four. A. Greenwald, Noah Rothman, and Sohrab Ahmari. I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.